Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's program, Update on Follicular Lymphoma. And I know this is a program that many of you have been waiting to hear us offer, and this is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and the Lymphoma Research Foundation. And we have collaborated on many programs together to bring information to you about what's all the updates on lymphoma. We also have collaborated with other organizations as well, and we have on the call today over 779 participants on the call today. And it's really because of our collaboration and because of your interest in this. You're really a very well-informed and a very interesting group of people who are really wanting to listen to this program today. So there's 779 of you on the call today. And you come from all over the United States, from all different regions and all different sized communities, from big cities to little cities to rural and frontier communities, so really from all the and suburban areas, from all different parts of the United States. And we have international participants from Bahrain, Canada, China, Fiji, France, Lebanon, Singapore, Taiwan, and the United Kingdom, so really from all over the world. Clearly a group of information seekers. Now, I would like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is an outline, which our speakers will be following, and there's information about all the different collaborating organizations and as a resource to you, and there is an evaluation form. And I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the programs and the topics that you would like us to offer? So please take a moment and tell us what you'd like us to do, and we'll try very hard to implement your suggestions. Indeed, this program today is one that you've been asking us to do, and here we have it. And, you know, this is, well, we are sort of into the year, but we're still sort of at the beginning of the year. It's springtime, and we're planning many more programs. So we very much welcome your feedback. Now, this program was supported through a grant to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Spectrum Pharmaceuticals. We really want to thank them for their support of our program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Stephanie Gregory. Dr. Gregory is the Elodia Kem Chair Hematology Professor of Medicine. She's also Director, Section of Hematology, Rush University Medical Center, Rush University. And Dr. Gregory is going to address an overview of follicular lymphoma, communicating with your healthcare team, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Gregory.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be here today, and I welcome everyone from all over. It's wonderful to have that many people whom we hope we can help in some way. So I'm just going to start with an overview of non-Hodgkin lymphoma and then speak specifically about follicular lymphoma. And I think that it's important to differentiate the non-Hodgkin lymphomas from the Hodgkin lymphomas. There are major differences. The Hodgkin lymphoma are very steady in their occurrence. There are only about 8,000 patients a year. It's not increasing in number, and it's a disease mainly of young people, a very highly curable disease. We're going to speak today about a specific type of non-Hodgkin lymphoma, which is increasing in number. It is one of the most common blood cancers that we see, and it is the sixth most common cancer of all the cancers and accounts for almost 70,000 new cases a year. Because we are improving our diagnosis and treatment of the lymphomas, the prevalence of the lymphomas is about 500,000 to 600,000 patients living with the disease today. I think that it's important to talk about the most common lymphomas that we see, and if I go into all the different kinds of non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, we'd actually be talking about 70 different kinds of lymphomas. And what I always tell my patients is most of you will have the most common kind of non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and follicular is the second most common. Remember that most of the lymphomas come from the normal immune system. And the immune system is made up of what we call B and T cells. These are lymphocytes. They're very important in helping us with immunity and fighting infections. And that 95% of all of the lymphomas are B-cell lymphomas, or around 90% of them are B-cell lymphomas. The remainder, 10 to 12%, are what we call T-cell lymphomas, and they are much rarer lymphomas. It is nice to sort of talk about the classification of the lymphomas, but I'm not going to go into that today because it's a very complicated classification based on what the pathologist sees under the microscope, based on some of the markers that we find on the surface of the cell, and also some of the chromosome abnormalities that can occur in some of these lymphomas. I think it's important for you to think about the lymphomas divided into low-grade or indolent, what we call intermediate grade or aggressive, and then high grade or very aggressive. And today we're going to talk about the most common low grade indolent lymphoma called follicular lymphoma. Now, I think it's important to think about follicular lymphoma as a disease that is in general something you can live with for years. On occasion, it may not need treatment initially. When it does need treatment, we have many novel therapies that we're treating patients with today. And in fact, we're trying to approach the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas in a way that we are doing no harm to the patient, that they may, if they need treatment again and again, we're not causing damage to them. The follicular lymphomas are in general consistent of three different grades of lymphoma. Now, I'll talk about staging lymphomas, but I'm specifically going to talk about how we grade lymphomas by the pathologist. And under the microscope, we can grade the follicular lymphomas by grades 1, 2, and 3. And this is what the pathologist sees under the microscope. It's usually grade 1 are all small cells. Grade 2 are some mostly small cells with a few large cells. And then follicular grade 3 is actually a lot of large cells, but still in a very nodular or follicular pattern that the pathologist sees. More recently, the pathologists have been able to differentiate between follicular grade 3A and B, and we can talk about that later. There may be some different approaches to treatment. Now, another term that you may hear when we talk about follicular lymphoma is a transformation. And that really is the importance of re-biopsying patients every time their disease comes back, especially if the disease comes back in one area only and it appears to be fairly large or what we call bulky. And, that everybody differs on what they call bulky, but I say something that's the size of a golf ball is bulky, or grapefruit is really bulky. And those certainly should always be biopsied, because when you biopsy that, if you're looking for what we call transformation, it is a diffuse background of all large cells, and that is then a transformation to what we call a diffuse large B cell, and that in itself is approached differently with treatment. The chance of transformation is about 3% per year. And remember, our patients with follicular lymphomas are living for a long time. We actually are talking about this as more of a chronic disease now. And, I want you to think of it as something that maybe is not necessarily curable, but that you can live with, such as diabetes and hypertension. And we are trying to make this into a more chronic disease, and therefore the different treatments every time the disease comes back are going to be important. Also, now I will talk about how we actually stage lymphomas, and that means how extensive is the disease throughout the body. And what you need to remember is that it is not just the stage that really is of importance prognostically. There are many other factors that we look at, and we'll talk a little bit about that. The follicular lymphomas, because they're slow growing and sometimes it takes a long time before we can actually diagnose them in a patient, you may have lymph nodes enlarging in your abdomen for a long time, and that may be a year. It could even be 2 years or more. But until you become either symptomatic from that or until you develop a swollen lymph node in your neck or under your arm that you notice, it may go undetected for a while. So by the time we do diagnose the follicular lymphomas, often they are pretty much disseminated diagnosis. And what I mean by that is that they are in many of the lymph nodes throughout the body, and they may be in the spleen, which is considered sort of a large lymph node. And because the lymph nodes and the blood vessels are so closely connected, you think about the lymph nodes as another blood organ. And so the lymph nodes follow the arteries and the veins throughout the body, and because they follow the blood vessels, there is often involvement also in the bone marrow, which is where the blood is made. Patients may have a very slow-growing indolent behavior. They may not be symptomatic, and in general can go many years either with or without treatment. So we've sort of covered the grades of lymphoma. Let's talk about how we stage the follicular lymphoma patients. We use the old staging system that was used for Hodgkin lymphoma, and that's the stages 1, 2, 3, and 4, symptoms or no symptoms, and that's referred to A or B. And so stage 1 is disease limited to one lymph node area, for example, in the neck area. Stage 2 is disease in two different lymph node areas, for example, the neck and under the arm, or the neck and in the chest area called the mediastinum. Stage 3 would be disease in the lymph nodes above and below the diaphragm, say, for example, lymph nodes in the neck and lymph nodes in the groin area. Stage 4 is when we always do a bone marrow in our patients with low-grade lymphoma because we want to see if there may be bone marrow involvement. And, in fact, in 60 to 70% of our patients, we do find the follicular lymphoma in the bone marrow. And if it's in the bone marrow, that makes it stage 4. Now, the bone marrow is not the only area where we could call stage 4. It's any place outside of the lymph nodes. So if we find disease in the liver or the lung or in the bone, that would also make a patient stage 4. And again, prognosis doesn't necessarily depend on the stage of the disease. Now, when we get a biopsy of the lymph node, and you must always get a good piece of tissue when we biopsy these, fine needle aspirates are not the way to diagnose a lymphoma, because what I mentioned to you earlier was under the microscope, some of these lymphomas look the same. But because there are so many different kinds of lymphomas, we have to actually look at the markers on the surface of the lymphoma cell. We have to do something called flow cytometry, where these actual single cells from the biopsy are put through a special machine, and they can actually look at certain markers on the surface of the cell. That's very important because these markers now are being used for targets of therapies. And you're going to hear about the monoclonal antibody rituximab, which is targeted against one of these markers on the surface of the cell called the CD20 marker. We also look at certain chromosome abnormalities that can occur in the lymphomas. And a specific chromosome abnormality occurs not in all the body cells of the patient with lymphoma, but only in the lymphoma cells. And that translocation is called a 14-18 translocation. It does lead to an overexpression of a protein called the BCL2 protein, which, in fact, helps keep these cells alive. So, again, these lymphoma cells are sometimes very resistant to dying. They're formed and they sit around a long time. They don't like to die, and that's because of this actual protein, overexpression of this protein that keeps them alive. Now, there are research techniques that are not being done by your physician and not being done routinely, but we are learning more and more about the follicular lymphomas by doing what we call gene array analysis and looking at the cells that make up the background of the tumor and also the cells of the tumor cells themselves. And actually, there have been identified some very definite patterns of gene expression in the follicular lymphoma, and it actually is looking at the background cells, the environment. When you think of cancer today, I think all of us are not only thinking about how the tumor cell grows, but it's also how that tumor cell grows in its environment. We sort of think about the seed is the tumor cell, and the soil is the environment for that seed to grow. And actually, by looking at special genes in the follicular lymphomas, we have found that the background genes are very important and that we now can talk about an immune response 1 signature and an immune response 2 signature, and that may prognosticate whether the patient's going to do well with a certain treatment or maybe not do so well with a certain treatment. We are not yet using that in the treatment of our patients, but it is still something that we're looking at as a research tool. And perhaps in the future, we will streamline treatment for our patients with follicular lymphoma, depending on what their gene expression profiles look like. Now, I should also mention another prognostic area that we look at when we talk about follicular lymphoma. We talk about the staging, so you can be a stage 1, 2, 3, or 4. You can either have no symptoms, and then you're called A, or you can have fevers, night sweats, or weight loss, and that's B. So you can be a 3A, you can be a 4B, you can be a 2A or a 1A, but that's very uncommon. Most of our patients with follicular lymphoma are 3 or 4. The other things we should talk about is perhaps are there any, you know, risk factors? What's causing these follicular lymphomas? And I suppose I should say, in general, there really are not any specific things that will cause follicular lymphoma. The lymphomas in general are increasing in number because of a large number of reasons. One is because it is an immune disorder, an immune cancer. If you suppress the immune system, you can get lymphomas. We see that in patients who have had transplanted organs. Certain viral infections can cause lymphomas. Certain bacterial infections can cause lymphomas. Exposure to radiation can cause lymphomas and toxic exposures. But for the follicular lymphoma in particular, we have not found any of these reasons being associated with the cause of the follicular lymphoma. I mentioned other ways of looking at the patient prognostically besides the staging, and that's called something called the FLIPI. And we look at the Follicular Lymphoma International Prognostic Index. And that is 5 things that we look at, and the mnemonic for that is NOLASH, L-A-S-H. NO is the number of nodal sites that we find on the CAT scan. You know, if you have neck nodes and groin nodes and lymph nodes in your abdomen, you may get a point against you. You have more than 4 nodal areas, you get 1 point. If you are over the age of 65, you get another point. If you have a blood test called the LDH that's elevated, you get a point. If you have a hemoglobin that's less than 12, you get a point. And if your stage is 3 or 4, you get a point. And then we add those points up, and we can put you into a low, intermediate, or high-risk category. And it, very loosely, it can predict survival. I need to tell you, though, that the FLIPI was put in place before the advent of the universally used treatment today called rituximab. And the rituximab added to either chemotherapy or rituximab alone has improved the survival of patients even with high-risk FLIPI. So I don't want you to hold on to that. If you think you're a high-risk FLIPI, that means you're necessarily going to die sooner. That's not necessarily true. But I think it's important to ask your doctor, what is my FLIPI score? I just think it's so important for you to take ownership of what you have and to ask questions. So we talked about non-Hodgkin lymphoma versus Hodgkin lymphoma. We talked about the difference between B-cell and T-cell. All of these that we've talked about today right now are B-cell lymphomas. We talked about the overall incidence, that it's increasing in number. It is a disease mainly of older patients, and I think that a lot of that has to do with the longer we live, the more hits we take to our immune system, the more we are exposed to different environmental factors. And our population is aging. It's been predicted that by the year 2020, more than 20% of the population will be over the age of 65. Now, you know, what is old? We don't know what's old today. 65 is not old today. 75 maybe is getting a little old, and then 85 is certainly old. But I think it really depends on your physiological status. How's your heart? How's your kidney? How are your lungs? It does not really reflect what your age is as to how you're going to respond to these lymphomas if you do get one of them. We talked about the diagnosis. We have to do blood tests. That should include this a complete blood count. It should look at your chemistries. It should include the test called the LDH level, which is a blood test that is used for the FLIPI calculation. There's another test I'm not going to spend much time on called the beta 2 microglobulin, which is also an important test for looking at your disease status. We also want to make sure your hemoglobin is good, that you're not anemic, and we also look at we mentioned the kidney function and everything else. Very rarely these lymphomas grow so slowly and so long that they may be growing only in the lymph nodes in your abdomen. And if the lymph nodes grow large enough in the abdomen and actually push on vital organs, for example, the tubes leading from the kidneys, the ureters, you actually may get some kidney problems. The kidney may enlarge and get blocked, and your kidney function may become abnormal. That's referred to as a hydronephrosis. And you may not even know about that because the lymph nodes are not in your neck or in your under your arms or in your groin area. And so that's the importance. If you have any symptoms that are different or fullness in your abdomen, that was something we often say to patients. You know, ask your doctor. Maybe a CAT scan is needed. The other thing that I need to remind you about is sometimes these lymph nodes enlarge in the groin area. And if you feel some very large lymph nodes in the groin area, that can block the circulation in the legs, especially the vein flow. And you may get swelling of the legs. I've seen some patients who had extreme swelling in their legs. And that also can lead to a blood clot in the veins in the legs. So these are just some of the ways that patients can present. But in general, our patients present with an enlarged lymph node. It is painless, and it is my philosophy that no lymph node that is painless should ever be treated with antibiotics. No matter where it is, it should be taken out. And I've seen too many patients who, receive antibiotics for 2 weeks, and they go back and it's not smaller, so they get another 2 weeks of antibiotics. These are many, many of the things that we try to avoid so that we can get a diagnosis of the lymphoma earlier rather than later. With follicular lymphoma, that is not the most important thing that we get a very early diagnosis because, in general, if you're not symptomatic, you don't have a lot of very large lymph nodes, we may not even suggest treatment initially. I'd like to turn now briefly about you taking charge of your disease. I don't want you to ever go into your doctor and be told that this is what needs to be done, this is what the regimen we're going to use. You need to be intelligent about this because what you get as your first-line treatment may reflect what you're going to get as your second-line treatment. And on an average, patients with follicular lymphoma live so long that they may have – I have one patient who's already had 10 different treatments for her follicular lymphoma over 20 years. And so our philosophy should be do no harm. And if this is not a disease that we're going to aim right up front to hit hard and get rid of, then maybe a little gentler treatment initially is something that you should have rather than a very aggressive approach. And so just remember, every time you get more chemotherapy drugs, you may get more damage to normal blood cells, and that can lead to secondary complications. So have your doctor discuss what he's going to do with you, not just now if you need treatment, but what you need down the road, second line or third line. And, you know, make sure you're not over-treated. That's so important. Take notes. Ask your doctor questions. Ask him what your risk factors are. Ask him what the FLIPI is. Ask him what stage you are. Keep a journal. Every time you go to your physician, I know what happens. My patients, I'm talking to them and they forget to ask questions, and then I may get a couple of phone calls. Well, write things down. Bring someone with you. Always, always go to the physician on your visit with a family member or someone who can actually take notes. I know I've been requested if they can record me forever and ever, and I don't like being recorded because, you know, you don't, you're maybe a little bit more guarded when you're being recorded. But, I certainly think your doctor is very willing to answer all of your questions, and never, never be afraid to ask for a second opinion. It is the doctor who is not confident in his own decision-making that would say to you, you don't need another opinion. And especially with follicular lymphoma, because there is really no standard of care. I mean, there are so many different treatments, as you're going to hear. You really don't need to make a decision right away unless you have a blocked kidney, or unless there's a risk of getting a blood clot in your leg, or unless you have fluid in your lung, or you have fevers and night sweats, you know, then maybe you won't have enough time. But that's such a rare occurrence that we always recommend a second opinion at an academic center. The other thing is, remember that we're really concerned about your quality of life. We don't want you in bed sick with chemotherapy if you don't need it. We want to preserve your quality of life. We want you to be able to keep working. We want you to enjoy the things that you have always enjoyed. We want you to keep doing those physical activities. We want you to go work out if that's part of your life. So we want to address that also. I think one of the most important things that maybe physicians have not addressed is the psychosocial needs of our patients. And the Institute of Medicine actually came out a few years ago saying that it is every hematologist, oncologist's obligation to their patient to ask them about integrating their care with other aspects of life. Would you like to speak to a social worker? Would you like to see a psychologist? You know, I can understand this is hard on your spouse and your children. Can we have a family conference, and can we have someone meet with you? We also offer our patients, other areas of massage therapy. There's acupuncture now for some patients who may want to get off pain medications. There are so many things out there that are available today, and I hope that you have a physician that is offering those to you. I'm going to end at this point. Please jot down your questions. I'm sure that I didn't answer everything that you have on your mind, but I would be very happy to answer those questions later. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Gregory, for really an outstanding presentation, so comprehensive, encyclopedic, and yet understandable by everybody. You really talked in a way that people could follow you, and just very helpful. So thank you, and I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. John Pagel. Dr. Pagel is Associate Member, Clinical Research Division, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, Associate Professor, Medical Oncology Division, UW Medicine Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. And Dr. Pagel is going to address new treatment approaches. He's going to discuss clinical trials and managing treatment side effects. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Pagel.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. What a difficult job it is to follow such an amazingly elegant presentation by Dr. Gregory. That was phenomenal. I have to tell everybody before I get started that I'm in Seattle, and I learned today that this is not spring. This is actually what we're experiencing here is called sprinter. It's part winter and part spring, and hopefully many of you are in Florida or in the nicer parts of the country enjoying some sunshine. I'll be jealous if you are. Nonetheless, what we're going to do over the next several minutes is just talk about treatment approaches, a little bit about clinical trials and what those might be and if those might be of interest to you, a little bit about side effects as well, and then address many, perhaps, more of these issues in some of the question and answer period. I think Dr. Gregory made some outstanding points about addressing this disease as somewhat of a palliative approach, a chronic care disease, understanding that the goals of treatment for patients can be markedly different. For patients who might be a little bit older, perhaps we don't want to be overly aggressive. Perhaps we want to just control some symptoms, or perhaps make you feel better by removing a lymph node that might be problematic or cosmetically not appealing. Those are easy goals to achieve and very reasonable as well. There are other people, of course, that are perhaps a little bit younger, want to be very aggressive in their treatments, and maybe those might achieve different goals. Those might be treatments that might lead to goals of trying to help you live longer or perhaps even keep your disease away for a longer period of time. So when we approach patients with follicular lymphomas, I think it's very important to remember that every patient's an individual. Every patient has different treatment goals, and all of those goals are very reasonable. So I commonly will have a conversation with my patients in the clinic by addressing lots of the treatments and what they might be, but really putting that into the context of what might be appropriate for each individual patient. Somebody, again, might be very conservative. They don't want to take a lot of risks. They may not want to lose their hair with some types of treatments. Maybe they're averse to certain things, such as perhaps some mild nausea or vomiting. And maybe taking a very, very conservative approach would be very reasonable. Somebody might be, again, at the other end of the spectrum, might want to be very aggressive and be willing to take some upfront risk, some of those things that we just talked about, accepting some of those side effects and managing those side effects with the idea that the goal or the outcome might be very important for maybe changing the natural history of that patient's disease. And, of course, there are many different spots in between this spectrum of different types of therapies that can be intermediary that might lead to different outcomes for different patients. So perhaps the most conservative thing that we can do for patients, of course, is watch and wait, observation. And Dr. Gregory addressed this a little bit in her prior presentation. However, I think it's very important to say that this is a routine approach, something that we all do all throughout the world, and it's very, very appropriate. Most patients, when they present, as Dr. Gregory said, will be asymptomatic. They feel well. They might have a little bit of lymph nodes enlarged, maybe under the armpit or in the neck. But otherwise, if they're doing well, have a small burden of disease, not bulky disease, no symptoms, it's very common and important to say that watch and wait is acceptable and appropriate. We've done that for many, many years and continue to do that. And that's very also appropriate for somebody who might be a little bit older, maybe somebody who might be 70, 75 years old or even older. A very conservative approach and only treating patients if and when the time comes. When the time comes might be because of, again, some symptoms. Maybe a lymph node has gotten a little too big and it's causing a little bit of discomfort, or maybe it's cosmetically less appealing. And those are all very good reasons to get treatment. But until we see those things, observation, watch and wait is very appropriate. When we have a need for treatment, however, there are lots of different treatment choices. And that, again, spreads out over that entire spectrum all the way up to the most aggressive forms of treatment that we might be able to offer. Another very easy conservative approach might be just some external radiation directly to a lymph node group. If you have very small disease, maybe just a lymph node that's in the groin that's causing a problem, as an example, it would not be uncommon to maybe address that with some radiation locally to that area and to eliminate that lymph node and hopefully reset the clock a little bit, at least in that area where the treatment was delivered. One of the limitations, of course, about external beam radiotherapy is that it is only addressing the field of radiation delivery. Since lymphoma is a systemic disease, it's widely systemic in most cases. In fact, as Dr. Gregory noted, usually presenting at stage 3 or 4, radiation might have a relatively limited role by addressing just one or two specific areas. So that's why we commonly use more systemic therapies, therapies that, of course, are delivered intravenously in most cases, and these can be a variety of different therapies. We've been using chemotherapies for many years and continue to use them, some of the mainstays that have been around for quite a long time. You've probably heard of course, CHOP, the CHOP regimen, maybe CVP, a fludarabine-containing regimen. And now there are other new chemotherapies that are available that are very exciting as well, and one in particular that I'm sure many patients have come to learn about in the last year or two would be bendamustine. Bendamustine is a new agent that we're combining with antibody therapies that also appears to be very promising, well-tolerated, with a relatively good manageable toxicity profile. Patients do well with most all these therapies as outpatients, feeling well and able to continue on with their normal activities, and bendamustine certainly falls into that kind of category. There are other chemotherapies that are not intravenous. There is a long-standing agent that we deliver orally known as chlorambucil, also a very reasonable agent that we can deliver that's well-tolerated and usually reserved for patients who might be a little bit older or not wanting more aggressive therapy. nonetheless, when we use all these therapies, we usually don't use chemotherapy alone. It's very uncommon in this day and age not to combine our chemotherapeutic approaches with an biologic therapy. In particular, the use of rituximab has really revolutionized treatments for indolent lymphomas like follicular lymphoma. Almost all B cells, as Dr. Gregory noted, are CD20 positive. That's that marker on the surface of these follicular lymphoma cells that the antibody rituximab attaches to. And we know that the antibody by itself can be used very effectively, very well tolerated, and can be used multiple times throughout the entire course of someone's disease. We also know that that therapy can be combined with chemotherapy as well, what we would call chemoimmunotherapy, the antibody being the immunotherapy portion of this. We know that when we combine rituximab with chemotherapy, it's not uncommon to see some additive effect of these agents. In fact, some people will say, and we believe, that these agents work synergistically, that the rituximab can help the chemotherapy work better, and the chemotherapy perhaps can help the rituximab work better. Very appealing approach, and it is very effective for eliminating follicular lymphoma cells. We also have some newer agents that are being used in clinical trials and observations, and we have some that are well tolerated that are being used in newer forms. And in particular, I would include the radiolabeled antibodies in that category, radioimmunotherapy. There are two FDA-approved radiolabeled antibodies. One is Zevalin, the other is known as Bexxar, and they're both approved in the relapse setting for patients with lymphoma, but now are being explored more commonly in patients in the upfront treatment setting. And in particular, the use of Zevalin in consolidation after achieving some type of remission from your upfront therapy has led to improvements in keeping people's disease away for longer periods of time, as well as extending the time till needing the next treatment for the patient's lymphoma. In addition to consolidation treatments with radiolabeled antibodies like Zevalin, we commonly do what we would call maintenance therapies. Now, this may or may not be for every patient. Some patients might like this idea, others may not. It's, again, an individualized approach for each patient. But maintenance, the idea, of course, would be that we want to get the best or deepest quality remission we can in patients, because we know that if we're able to achieve that, at a minimum, we can help people's disease stay away for longer periods of time. So it's not uncommon for patients to get some upfront treatment, perhaps rituximab and CHOP chemotherapy as an example, and then to go on to get maintenance therapy, perhaps periodic dosing of some type of treatment, and usually this would be single-agent antibody treatment like rituximab every few months, maybe even every 6 months, for a couple of years at least in most cases. So again, this is kind of how we've evolved with some of our treatments, thinking about getting a good remission up front and then either consolidating in many cases with a radiolabeled antibody or perhaps giving some type of maintenance therapy. Lastly, I'll just mention that perhaps the most aggressive form of treatment we can offer to patients is stem cell transplantation. Now, stem cell transplantation is a topic that is complex and something that would take perhaps many minutes to discuss in detail that would provide adequate knowledge about this. But I would just mention that stem cell transplants are an option for many patients, but they're probably not an option for most patients. They're not something that most patients need to consider, worry about, or even think about in the near future. It's usually reserved for patients who have failed multiple types of treatments and are able to undergo that kind of approach and be able to tolerate it relatively well. Transplants usually come in one of two different forms. They're either what we would call autologous transplants using the patient's own stem cells, or they're allogeneic transplants using someone else's stem cells. When we use the patient's own stem cells, what we do is we take those stem cells, isolate them from the blood, and put them in the freezer and store them for when we need them. We'll come back with very high doses of chemotherapy, perhaps even some radiation at some point, and we go ahead and try and kill every single lymphoma cell that we possibly can, hopefully eradicate the disease if that's possible, but we will also kill the normal bone marrow. So we'll pull those cells back out of the freezer, reinfuse them, Those cells know how to find the bone marrow, repopulate the bone marrow, and go on to make normal stem cells, normal blood cells. When we use a allogeneic donor, someone else, maybe a sibling or somebody who would have a very similar tissue type match, we know that we can do that in a safe way for most patients. And the goal there would be to harness the immune system from the donor and use that immune system from the donor to eradicate the disease. That's a brief overview on transplant. Of course, again, as I want to iterate, that's probably not something that most patients need to worry about or think about, but it is an option down the road for many people. I think the most important treatment option for patients to consider that is not widely recognized in most doctors' offices might be participation in a clinical trial. Clinical trials are an outstanding option in many settings for many patients. There are trials that are available in most settings, upfront, relapse, refractory patients, maybe even as part of a stem cell transplant as well, but they're not available widespread throughout the entire country. Not every trial would be, for instance, here in Seattle. So you need to do a little bit of exploration for a trial, and why would you want to do that? Well, clinical trials are testing new promising agents. Obviously, these are important steps that need to be taken to make sure that drugs are safe, and that they work, and that they are actually important for providing a benefit to patients. Without studying them in a very controlled environment, it's very hard to be able to answer those questions. So drugs in oncology are always approved through a series of clinical trials. And when drugs get to clinical trials in oncology, and in particular in lymphoma, and in particular in follicular lymphoma, they have profound evidence behind them that have supported their advancement to this stage of development. So they may have a lot of early laboratory-based data that looks promising, and many times these trials will have been in prior trials that have been extremely promising, suggesting that they warrant further exploration. So participating in a clinical trial is typically very relevant and provides the patient an opportunity to get a drug that they wouldn't normally perhaps be able to get. It's rare to randomize anything in oncology towards a placebo, so I wouldn't expect at all that that would be a concern for any patient. Patients usually are randomized, if it is a randomized study, to the standard of care or something very appropriate for the patient. So at best, you are getting something better than the standard of care, and at worst, the standard of care in many cases. I will say that there are many trials that are very exciting that have been recently performed that have been really dramatically changing how we treat patients with follicular lymphoma, and I've kind of mentioned these. The PRIMA trial you may have heard of, it's the maintenance rituximab trial, or the FIT trial that used Zevalin and consolidation, which showed a significant improvement in keeping people's disease away for a longer period of time. If you're interested in clinical trials, and I believe that really almost everybody should be interested in at least exploring a clinical trial, you can find out a lot about them by asking your doctor, of course, and exploring reputable sites on the Internet. I would encourage you to look at clinicaltrials.gov. I think the Lymphoma Research Foundation has an outstanding site that can direct you in the right way, Leukemia and Lymphoma Society as well. Lots of resources out there. Ask your doctor if there's a clinical trial right for you. I think I've talked way too long, and I'm going to turn it back to Carolyn and then to Brian, and I appreciate everybody for listening to me today. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Pagel. You did a wonderful, wonderful presentation, just wonderful job, and you really covered so many important issues around treatment and managing side effects and the importance of clinical trials. So I know there'll be questions to you, and thank you so much for your really outstanding presentation. Our next speaker is Brian Tomlinson. Now, Brian has been critically important in planning this program, both planning the program and accessing support for the program, so I really want to thank Brian. And Brian is Chief Program Officer, Lymphoma Research Foundation. And as I mentioned earlier, we've had a long collaborative effort with Lymphoma Research Foundation, and I have to say that we're planning more programs for this year, so we're very excited about that. And I'm going to turn this over to Brian, who's going to talk about the free support programs that you can access from the Lymphoma Research Foundation. Brian?
Thank you, Carolyn, and again, thank you to you and your team at Cancer Care for a wonderful continued partnership on all the calls we present for people affected by the disease. I'd also like to thank our esteemed faculty, Drs. Gregory and Pagel, for joining us today. These two individuals give countless hours, days, and weeks of their time to help the Lymphoma Research Foundation develop materials and put on our programs, as well as making sure that all of their patients are seen and treated. So we really do thank them, not only for their time today, but for all they do for us throughout the year. And lastly, I would like to acknowledge Spectrum Pharmaceuticals for supporting today's call. The Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest nonprofit organization, and we're devoted exclusively to funding innovative lymphoma research and providing people with lymphoma and healthcare professionals with information about the disease. Our mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by this disease. We invest millions of dollars each year to combat the disease and assist those whose lives have been affected by a lymphoma diagnosis. We remain dedicated to identifying a cure and to helping members of the lymphoma community by providing comprehensive disease-specific programs and services. Since the organization's inception, we've funded over $45 million in lymphoma research. This includes over $7 million for follicular research, and we've committed to another $2 million of research in follicular lymphoma over the course of the next year. More than 35,000 people access our programs and services each year. These programs and services include a lymphoma helpline where our professional public health and mental health staff can assist you in your search for information about the disease as well as appropriate resources. Dr. Pagel spoke about finding information on clinical trials. A member of our helpline team can help you in your search for information and help you navigate through the different clinical trials that are available. We have a national one-to-one peer support program that's called our Lymphoma Support Network, where we will match you with lymphoma patients or caregivers who've had similar lymphoma-related experiences. We have a variety of publications and newsletters, including 4 comprehensive disease guides and over 20 different disease-specific fact sheets. We have a follicular fact sheet as well as a relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma fact sheet. I would encourage all of you, if you don't have these resources, to please visit our website or to contact a member of our helpline team. And we have a number of informational e-newsletters. In addition to these programs, we have webcasts and podcasts that are available on our website that talk about the different types of lymphoma, treatment options, and the variety of support topics. And we offer in-person patient conferences on the local, regional, and national level. Again, for more information about any of these programs or services, please contact a member of the Lymphoma Helpline by calling us at 1-800-500-9976 or visiting us on our website at lymphoma.org. Again, thank you, Carolyn, Dr. Pagel, Dr. Gregory, and Spectrum for supporting today's call. We greatly appreciate it. Carolyn?
Oh, thank you so much, Brian, and thank you for all the work that you do in the Lymphoma Research Foundation and also for really making these programs possible. And it's always a pleasure to work with you, so thank you. Our next speaker is Rick Dickens. Rick is an oncology social worker. He's Blood Cancer's Program Coordinator, Mind, Body, Spirit Project Coordinator, Cancer Care. And Rick is going to tell you about the services that you can access from Cancer Care. Rick?
Thank you, Carolyn. And I, too, want to thank Drs. Gregory and Pagel for terrific, informative presentations, and Brian especially for the terrific work of Lymphoma Research Foundation. A diagnosis of lymphoma is difficult for patients and those who love and work with them. Cancer Care has over 40 master's degree social workers specializing in oncology who are here to help you resolve some of the conflicts that might arise and ultimately help you find some peace. Now, that might be emotional peace through one of our many professionally facilitated telephone, online, and face-to-face groups, or in a counseling intervention with one of our oncology social workers. It might be peace that you can be some respite from financial concerns through one of our financial grants or one of our cancer care fact sheets that address financial resources. And finally, knowledge and peace of mind can come through one of our Connect workshops like today, or guidance on how to navigate the complicated world of cancer treatment, healthcare communication, insurance issues, or community-based resources that you weren't aware of. Tips that can guide you along this process: do your research. The Internet is a good place to start, but there are also many helpful organizations such as Cancer Care that can guide you through this process. Becoming a knowledgeable consumer will go a long way toward giving you a sense of control and making you an active member in your treatment decisions. Take your time. saying I need a day to think about this can give you an opportunity to catch your breath and get feedback from loved ones and from other resources. And finally, as has been mentioned, speak up. Remember, your doctor and oncology team can't treat a problem if you don't make them aware of it. At Cancer Care, we can't promise to solve all of the concerns that arise out of a lymphoma diagnosis and treatment. But with over 60 years in the ever-changing field of oncology, we are dedicated to trying one patient and one family at a time. You can reach Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE or online at www.cancercare.org. Thank you.
Well, thank you very, very much, Rick, for just your eloquent description of cancer care services and how people can access them. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to bring all of our speakers on board, and I'm going to also ask Mary to explain to you how to queue up for questions. Now, I do want to say, because there are so many of you on the call today, that if you do not get to ask your question, please do contact either the Lymphoma Research Foundation or Cancer Care for follow-up in terms of your questions. You can call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE or the Lymphoma Research Foundation at 1-800-500-9976. We're all standing by for your questions, but we're going to take as many as we can now. So, Mary, could you explain how to queue up for questions and bring all of our speakers on board, everybody, and we'll start.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Elaine F.
Yes, this is for Dr. Pagel. You mentioned bendamustine for lymphomas that come back. I have indolent marginal zone NHL, but they don't do seminars just for those, so follicular as close as I could get. What would be, are you saying they combine the bendamustine with an antibody? What would that antibody be, and that would that be the treatment of choice right now when it comes back?
Thank you very much for that question. I'm going to ask Dr. Pagel to address your question in a general way, and then we're going to encourage you to go back to your treating healthcare team. Dr. Pagel?
Yeah, I think this is a really good question because bendamustine is an agent that we're seeing more and more of, people getting treated more and more with that agent. But it typically it's not used as a single agent. So normally what we would probably do is combine it with Rituxan. And it's being used in upfront settings as well as relapse settings and explored widely in clinical trials. So I think getting bendamustine or rituximab is an option, but it's not the only option. There are lots of options. And getting the same treatment more than once is also an option. So, again, this comes down to that individualized therapy that you might get with your doctor in a conversation to have. But bendamustine or rituximab is well-tolerated. You won't lose your hair. You'll feel fine throughout that for the most part, I would expect, and do very well. But one of the treatment choices you can get.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Barry M.
Hello.
Hi, Barry. Your question?
Yes, thank you. In addition to having the follicular lymphoma, for which I'm not being treated, watchful waiting, I also have a 10-year experience with CML. I've been treated with the Novartis drug for that, Gleevec. My question is, when the time comes for certain treatments, is this going to prove to be a problematic for me, having the other treatment?
Thank you very much for that excellent question. I'm going to ask Dr. Gregory to address your question in a general way, and then we're going to have you, of course, go back to your treating healthcare team. Dr. Gregory?
Right, and that's a very interesting question because we don't see many patients that do have two malignancies at the same time, although I have to admit I am beginning to see more and more patients who have two lymphoma, different types of lymphomas or a lymphoma and a myeloma at the same time. And, you know, it's very interesting that if you do need treatment for your follicular lymphoma, that probably will not interfere dramatically with the treatment for your CML unless you're getting a relatively aggressive approach. Certainly with a monoclonal antibody alone, such as rituximab, occasionally we will see a drop in the white count with that drug, but not dramatically dropping, and so you could probably still take the Gleevec. Your physician may determine that you would stop the Gleevec during the time you received cytotoxic therapy, if you had to receive something, for example, like bendamustine and rituximab. And so, I mean, that's going to be a decision depending on how much treatment your follicular lymphoma needs, where your CML is at the present time. Actually, at this point, I have one patient with CML who is undergoing treatment for another malignancy, and we just stopped her Gleevec for the time period, and she is still staying very nicely in a remission for her CML. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Patty D.
Yes. thank you, Dr. Gregory, for your exquisite presentation and for taking my question. You touched on transformed lymphoma. Have there been any new developments in that area beyond the gold standard of CHOP, which many of us who received it as an upfront treatment can't take, of course, because we can't repeat it.
Right. So thank you for that question. And, again, I think that's why we're trying to move away from CHOP or Rituxan as frontline treatment for follicular lymphoma. And remember what I said, there's no standard of care. Many people now are getting the single-agent rituximab alone, or if they need chemotherapy, many of us are using bendamustine plus rituximab. And so I have always tried to reserve CHOP for the transformed lymphoma, and certainly I have moved patients on to stem cell transplant if they're young enough without comorbid conditions, and many of them have done extremely well. And I think the old story of transformation is a death sentence is no longer true. We have seen many patients who transform locally in just one lymph node area. They respond very nicely to either a CHOP or Rituxan regimen or something called RICE and can move on to a transplant and have done very, very well.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Raphael F.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. My question is about maintenance Rituxan, and specifically the RESORT trial. Can either doctor explain why the results from that trial are so delayed? Many of us who are considering maintenance are waiting for those results, and it just seems a little strange.
Raphael, thank you for that question. Dr. Pagel, could you address that question, please?
Okay, sure. I'm happy to, and maybe Stephanie will have some input as well. I mean, ultimately, we don't know the answer of why the results are delayed, but likely it has to do with the number of outcomes that they've seen to date. So when we look at these clinical trials, we are basing them on statistical outcomes to achieve an endpoint that will lead us to an overall conclusion from the study. And likely what happens is that sometimes those responses or events, maybe a relapse described as an event, might not happen as fast as we might expect. And so it might take longer than we would expect before we can report on the trial. That doesn't mean that the trial won't be positive, or it also doesn't mean that the trial won't be negative. We just don't know. So we're just going to have to wait and see.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers today. You've really been outstanding, just an outstanding group of speakers, and also all of you who've queued up and asked such wonderful questions. And I want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you have many needs that a one-hour program may not fully address. And so I do want to remind all of you that although the program will soon be ending, the services that you can access from the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care, those are endless. They continue forever for you. And to some extent, that's really important for you to really take away. Most importantly, I don't want anyone to feel that you are alone in coping with lymphoma, with follicular lymphoma. I want you to feel that you're now part of a community of support, and we are here to help you. The Lymphoma Research Foundation's phone number is 1-800-500-9976. And Cancer Care's phone number is 1-800-813-HOPE. And both of those numbers and websites, all that information is in your materials. And, of course, we have many other organizations that you can contact as well. Most importantly, as we conclude today, feel that you may have a question or concern. You may think of something either today or in a couple of days or a week from now. Please do call us. We are here for you. And these are free services that you can access. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.